Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. I'm Renda Slim, director of the program on conflict resolution and track to dialogues at the Middle East Institute. We are very pleased that you have joined us for this expert discussion on Iraq's energy sector. We are live streaming and recording this discussion for posting on MEI website, so please silence your mobile devices, and we encourage tweeting and ask that you use hashtag MEI Iraq. I would like to call, before we turn to this panel, I would like to call your attention to another event which the Program on Conflict Resolution and Track to Dialogue at the Middle East Institute will be hosting this Wednesday, March 7, from 2:30 to 4, focusing on regional cooperation in the Middle East, discussing an initiative which we concluded in Baghdad last December. So, and we will have Mr. Nawfal Hassan, Deputy Chief of Staff to Prime Minister Abadi, on the panel. We will have Dr. Abdullah Derderi from the World Bank and Dr. Paul Salem. And it will be an interesting discussion, so please join us. Now, let's turn to today's event. Today's panel will discuss the challenges facing Iraq's oil sector and pathways to enabling better governance of this crucial sector for Iraq's political and economic future. I think the audience is quite savvy, but let me just say, I mean, this is an important sector for Iraq, present and future. It generates 90% of Iraq's government revenue, and 90% of all Iraqi exports and nearly 60% of the overall GDP. So how this sector moves forward is important for the politics of the country, but also for the security and the growth and economic development of the country. The story of the sector so far in Iraq has been one of a half-full, half-empty glass. On the half-full, on the positive side, we have seen Iraq output rise by almost 1.7 million barrels per day, with a current daily output of 4.4 million barrels, still short of the projected 6 million by 2020, and long way behind Saudi Arabia's 10 million barrels per day. On the half-empty story is that the sector still suffers from disputes and issues with resource management, revenue sharing, export authority, and as is the case with energy everywhere, politics and the politics of the place as well as the politics of the region have impacted the development of the sector and have prevented it from harnessing its full potential. To discuss this all-important topic, we have assembled a terrific panel of experts about Iraq, the oil sector, and energy issues writ large, and about U.S. policy vis-à-vis the energy sector in Iraq. You have our panelists' professional biographies in your program booklet. I will say a few words about each of them before turning to the discussion. I'll start with Erin Benko. She's an investigative reporter at the Star Ledger and NG.com, where she focuses on the intersection of money and government. She is the author of a book titled Pipe Dreams, The Plundering of Iraq's Oil Wealth. It's available for purchase outside. When we are finished here, you are welcome to go and purchase it. We have Alan Eyre. He's the director of the Middle East and Asia Office for the State Department Bureau of Energy Affairs, where he ensures strategic energy considerations are integrated into U.S. policy for this region. And interestingly and importantly, Alan was a member of the U.S. government team that negotiated the July 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. Next to Erin, we have Omar Al-Hindawi. He's the Iraq director at Griffin Partners, a strategic advisory firm in Washington, D.C., and he's a guest lecturer on Iraq history at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute, and he's the author of numerous articles and reports on Iraq and the Iraqi oil sector. Last but not least is my colleague at the Middle East Institute and at SAIS, Dr. Jean-François Seznec. He's a senior scholar at MEI, adjunct professor at SAIS, and his expertise and research focus is on the energy-based industries in the Gulf. In terms of how we are going to proceed with this panel, we will start with each of the panels taking 5 to 8 minutes to discuss specific issue related to the topic at hand. Amar Hindawi will start us off talking about the political challenges, focusing on the hydrocarbon law, which has been lingering in the Iraqi parliament since 2007. And also he will be talking about the ongoing dispute between Baghdad and KRG over revenue sharing and export authority. Aaron will then address the governance challenges of the oil sector in Iraq, including, among others, corruption, lack of transparency in the Iraq oil sector, arbitrage, and the KRG in particular, and also talk about, as she put it, the failure of the sector today, or of the revenue today, to promote the kind of equitable economic distribution, you know, of these resources that they should have done if the sector were to be better managed. Jean-François will focus on the resource challenges and the institutional challenges that are needed to harness fully the sector potential. And then Alain will conclude this first round of presentations by discussing how the U.S. Can work with Baghdad in the rebuild to address the challenges facing the Iraqi oil sector. We will then do another round of questions moderated by me among the four panelists for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then we'll leave the last 35 minutes for interaction with the audience. Questions from you, answers from them. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Omar. Faddal Omar.
Thank you, Ali. So since I'm starting first, I guess it's appropriate to set the stage with a little bit of historical background of the issue. And I think many of the audience is familiar with Iraq, and so I assume that the issue of, or like the disagreement between Baghdad and Erbil over the management of oil resources, oil and gas, has been one of the most complicated and enduring disputes between the two sides since the regime change in Iraq in 2003. Disagreements about how to, who owns the resources, who develops them, who has the authority to monetize them, and how that revenue is to be shared. In the 2005 constitution that both sides had agreed to, there was a basic framework that was to set the general principle that under which Iraq's oil revenue would be generated and distributed. But from the get-go, as the two sides went on to try and draft a law that would basically expand on those principles and set a legal and working legal framework for implementing those provisions, disagreements started to emerge. Disagreements about how, in the shape of inconsistencies in the way that each side interpreted what was discussed and what was agreed to, and what was the language versus the spirit of the Constitution, or what the Constitution said about the oil. So the first draft, the one that was probably the closest to an agreement between the two sides, has been lingering in Parliament since February of 2007. And from that point, the views have diverged, and each side started to implement its own policies, developing its oil resources in the way it saw most fitting for its conditions. The KRG was armed with a more stable political environment, a more stable security situation, and it created a more attractive commercial system in terms of the production sharing agreements that it presented. While Baghdad was, you know, lacking in terms of the political and security fronts, it had presented the attractive, massive reserves that the southern oil fields had promised investors. So, I think the situation that emerged from that is that neither side felt there was under pressure to agree to a law, and as they felt more and more confident in their positions and then their approach that they were taking, their views continued to diverge from apart, and the gap started to grow. When they went back actually to the negotiations table several years later, after the 2010 government formation, they completely discarded the 2007 draft. And the cabinet of the federal government actually presented a new draft that was more aggressive in centralizing authority over oil resources in the hands of the central government. The KRG responded by sponsoring a competing draft that was more aggressive in putting more powers in the hands of regional and provincial governments. And as we speak, no progress has happened as those three drafts continue to hang around. Now, throughout those years, multiple ad hoc deals have been made between the KRG and Baghdad in a way, in an attempt to normalize relations, by the KRG to secure funds from the federal budget, and to allow Baghdad, or in a way that it was Baghdad's attempt. Baghdad's objective was to secure more control over the KRG oil production, but those deals were often broken as soon as they started. Each side would accuse the other of not adhering to the terms and to adhering to the terms of those deals. And as Baghdad built up production capacity, as the KRG built up production capacity, they both felt even more and more comfortable in not committing to those deals. That, I think, reached new levels in 2014 when the KRG started exporting oil on its own, independently from the federal government, through the new oil pipeline going through Turkey. And later that year, by controlling the Kirkuk oil fields and adding about 300,000 barrels per day of capacity to its production network, reaching a comfortable 600,000 barrels per day export. Now, things took a sharp turn to the left in September of last year. The KRG, feeling economically more independent and feeling or perceiving a suitable regional environment, decided to go ahead with a referendum on independence. That caused backlash by Baghdad, also by neighbors Turkey and Iran. The government, the central government in Baghdad, decided to send federal troops to reclaim the city of Kirkuk and the oil fields that surround it. And that 280,000 or 300,000 barrels of oil switched overnight back to the Iraqi government. Now, it's against this backdrop that the two sides have been negotiating the terms of the 2018 federal budget. And over the weekend, actually, we saw that the Iraqi parliament has passed a new budget that actually ignored Kurdish objections to the large extent, at least as reported right now. The Kurds have always been demanding a percentage of 17% from the federal budget. Baghdad, feeling stronger in its position after capturing Kirkuk,
which they used back
in the day, yes. But the turn of events has encouraged Baghdad to argue for a reduced share of revenue down to 12.6%. Now, the new draft, actually, the new budget doesn't specify the exact percentage, but it leaves it to the Prime Minister and Cabinet to decide what is the proportion that is appropriate depending on the population of the provinces of the Kurdistan Regional Government. So we'll see how the KRG responds. The terms are not good. I think the KRG is facing two difficult options. One is to accept a budget that falls short of meeting its needs and expectations, or to ignore it altogether and go back to relying on its own resources. But the problem is that was an option probably a year ago when 600,000 barrels per day of production were available. Now when you're down to 250,000, it's a different game. That said, I think there is still a possibility that the math could provide the KRG with an opportunity to gain more revenue through the federal government than through independent exports. But the devil is in the details about how Baghdad will calculate that revenue. Now, looking forward, I think despite these tensions, there is a chance, there's a slightly stronger chance that an agreement on the oil and gas law will be reached in the 2018-2020 term. Not a great opportunity, not a great chance, but it's a better chance than before. And I think some of the reasons, or the main reason, is that the overall normalization of the hydrocarbon policy is not a luxury anymore for either side. And a few of the considerations that are important to note here with the referendum, with the Kurdish referendum in the rearview mirror, the KRG will probably have to focus on rebuilding a working relationship with Baghdad. The next push to independence could be a decade or more away. So in the interim, there will have to be some kind of agreement on revenue sharing to make sure that the Kurdish population receives its fair share of the nation's wealth. The second is that this is more of a technical point, is that the KRG's Kurdistan region's potential oil didn't really live up to expectations. The official line several years ago was about talking about 45 billion barrels of oil reserves, and even counting Kirkuk aside, you know, you have about 30 plus billion barrels of oil. If you look at the map today, if you look at the production map, the reserves map, we're talking probably single digit billion barrels of oil. So the currently producing and prospective oil fields in the Kurdistan region are probably on par with a second tier oil field from Iraq south, on par with probably Halfaya or Zubair at best. So there's a silver lining to that, which is that the risk to both sides of accepting one or the other of the contractual models that they have is kind of less, because the reserves at stake are less. And the old drafts previous drafts of the oil law had allowed for a period of time to reconcile those existing contracts with the new system. Now, one more point is that Baghdad also has an incentive to agree on a new framework, because it needs an export route for Kirkuk. Yes. Those 300,000 barrels of oil are locked in since October, and there's damage that's happening to the reservoirs because the oil is being reinjected. So the KRG pipeline offers a chance, actually, an opportunity for the two sides to cooperate and to the benefit of all. So to close, I think thinking strategically, the KRG could see benefit from securing the rights of the Kurdish population from federal resources in an agreement. But I think also Baghdad should do its part, perhaps walk back from that aggressive 2011 draft, which was prepared by Deputy Prime Minister Shahristani at the time, and move closer back to the 2007 draft, which was more in the middle between the two sides. And I'll stop here.
Thank you. Eric, please. Hi, everybody. So I wear a bit of a different hat than most of the other people on the panel. I'm a journalist and storyteller first and foremost, and so just remember that as we're going through the panel. So my goal today is really to bring to the forefront of the conversation, hopefully, some of the testimonies that I received while reporting for several years in Iraq. My book is Pipe Dreams, The Plundering of Iraq's Oil Wealth, but the focus is in the northern region of Iraq in Kurdistan. And the reason for that is I was working for news organizations that were sending me there at the time, so that's where my focus was. So I worked on my book for several years. I spent some time in Iraq exploring the oil sector during my coverage of the rise of the Islamic State group. A lot of the book stems off of, you know, hundreds of interviews I did with local people, talking to them about what they feel is the biggest issue for them moving forward. And I think that kind of conversation can often get lost when we talk about ways to move forward in Iraq. So I want to make sure that we get to that. Another part of the book stems off of interviews I did with regulatory enforcement officers in both the U.S. and the U.K., talking about the oil sector in Kurdistan. In my mind, the KRG is a classic case of the resource curse. The book deals with issues around corruption, transparency in oil, It looks at how the oil sector emerged and how it changed over time. It details the largely unregulated market and how political families and leaders found comfort and wealth in that market. And I think when having a conversation about the future of Iraq, I think it's important to understand and talk about these issues, corruption, transparency, the economy. We're in a post-referendum period, and we're at a time where we have an impasse between Erbil and Baghdad. We have elections coming up, and so I think sometimes these issues can get lost. So hopefully we can talk more about those today. I think now we're, as Omar said, we're beginning to see a sort of pathway forward, in a sense. We have an international auditing firm in Kurdistan looking at oil revenues in the region, though it only goes back just a few years. In my mind, it probably should have gone back even further. I don't necessarily agree with that it's too little too late, which some people do feel that the audit is too little too late. I found that the common denominator, though, when I was in Iraq talking to the people, was that the majority of people are just really interested in making ends meet and putting food on the table at night. That is their main concern. And an ability, their abilities to find jobs, to hold those jobs, to get paid for those jobs. As we all know, there was a period in the region where civil servants were not being paid because the economy was in a tailspin. It still is in a tailspin. And so a lot of these people felt that, you know, going back to 2003, 2004, that their lives would be immeasurably better. That, you know, contractors and multinational companies coming into the region would bring jobs and wealth, and that their lives would be quite different. For a lot of people, they don't, they feel like those dreams have been lost. And a lot of the people I spoke to are quite cynical about their future. While others are feeling a bit better about things. But as I said, I think the sort of main denominator throughout all of my years reporting on this book was that people just want to go to bed at night having done the best for their families, you know. And I think that kind of conversation can often get lost when we're talking about, you know, the oil technicalities or, you know, law. Resolutions. So let's see. So I think fixing the economy is going to be an important step in finding a way forward, at least in the northern region, and that will in large part be dependent on the negotiations between Erbil and Baghdad on revenues. But I think in thinking through all of this, it's important to remember that the impact on local people is really important and central to the conversation. I think that we won't really know what their lives will look like until we have the elections, until these negotiations are over. And I think that in terms of the way the economy will grow in the region will be, as I said, really dependent on the current negotiations over oil revenues. And so my book really focuses not on the technicalities of the oil sector itself, but the sort of negotiations that go on behind the scenes, the ways in which people react to those negotiations. And I think a lot of people also feel left in the dark about sort of what's going on behind closed doors. A lot of people are sort of cynical about politics in general in the region. Some have stopped following it completely. Others are very, very tuned in to the media and the television channels and are sort of really clued in. But I think the common denominator, as I said, is that people are very frustrated about where their economy is at right now and more so just want negotiations to move forward in either direction so that at least they'll have peace in their mind that at least things are moving forward. And so, you know, as we go forward in the panel, feel free to ask me any questions about, you know, the people I talk to. There are some really interesting testimonies in the book. I talk a lot about what local people have described to me as trickle-down corruption, where they have seen it spread not only from, you know, within ministries and the political sphere, but also in all the way down into the very local, you know, engineering, construction sectors, you know, hospitals, what have you. And I think that was a really interesting part of my time in Iraq and talking to people. So I'm going to leave it there. As I said, I think that, you know, moving forward in Iraq, it's important to keep this kind of conversation about corruption and transparency and impact on the local economy and what how the people feel at the forefront of the conversation.
Thank you. Jean-François. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, although I'm not really an Iraqi specialist, as you sort of made me, Aranda, but I do follow the events a little bit because of the oil issues. But it's quite easy to be pessimistic about Iraq, and I probably will not change your mind after I make my list of what I think needs to be done, but and I certainly don't want to sound cynical. It's more to that I'm a bit disappointed about what's happening. But one thing that really bothers me when I read all the articles on Iraq is the very positive feelings and descriptions of what will happen in the very near future, as given by the Minister of Oil, the Prime Minister, and any other official of Iraq, where they're going to produce 5 million barrels a day, the refineries will be operational anytime soon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there are maybe 7 small points which have to be established before this can happen.
All of them are small.
One is the negotiation on using the, as Omar mentioned, negotiations by the Iraqis and the KRG to use the KRG pipeline. There's 700,000 capacity there in the pipeline, which is not used. And now that the Iraqis have retaken the Kirkuk field, they'd rather keep the oil in the ground than export it, which, of course, as you mentioned, is bad for the fields. Another thing that could be done by the Iraqis, and which is very much in the plans, is to rebuild the Baji to Ceyhan pipeline. And that has been totally destroyed, of course. And it's a 1.2 million barrels per day pipeline, which is quite large. They don't really need to make it that large, but I just should remind you that this pipeline used to be the tail end of the North-South Strategic Pipeline, which was one of the wonders of Iraq in the oil industry, where they could ship their oil north to south and south to north, depending on the market conditions. And that was truly one of the very few pipelines in the world that could do that. And the Iraqis had the capacity, the engineering, and the knowledge to do it. And that, of course, has been destroyed for a long time. I mean, ever since the invasion of Iraq in the 90s. So, but if they did rebuild this 1.2 line between Baji and Ceyhan, which would help the Iraqis to regain some of the market share and to use the Kirkuk pipeline, Kirkuk field, they could rebuild that north-south pipeline. And I think that would be a very major plus for Iraq if that were going to happen. Perhaps immediate concern is the fact that for the past maybe 5 years, the Iraqis have been unable to allow ExxonMobil and CNPC of China to build the water pipeline, which was supposed to bring seawater from the Gulf for injection into the oil fields of the south. It's called the CSSP. If you excuse me, I will not tell you what it means. But it's a seawater pipeline, quite large. It's supposed to be 12 million barrels per day pipeline, which Exxon has been ready to start building for 5 years at least. And they cannot, none of the big companies that are in joint ventures or in technical service agreement contracts with Iraq, none of them can fulfill their requirements until this pipeline is built. And the people at ExxonMobil and CNPC are pulling their hair because they can never get the right agreements to have this pipeline built. And without this pipeline, the increasing production to 5 million barrels a day is a pipe dream, if you excuse the expression. Very poor jokes here. But anyway, another thing that we have to look for, which would greatly help, would be to redevelop the Kirkuk field. The Kirkuk field was one of the largest, the third largest oil field in the world. And it has been aging. It's an old field, one of the first ones exploited in the Middle East. But it still has a lot of reserves, but it's in very poor shape now, and it needs very high technology to develop it. BP had agreed to do it before all the problems. and are still willing to do it, but they are not able to, even if they spend the billions of dollars it will take to refurbish this field, they will not be able to export until there is an agreement either from the KRG and Iran and Iraq, and or they rebuild the Bajie-Ceyhan pipeline, in which case we're all talking lots of problems and a lot of money. So those are very small points, really, that need to be resolved. And without any of them moving forward, I really don't see how things are going to move forward. And I think, I'm not in a position to advise anybody, but the fact that these promises from the government all the time, and we'll do this and we'll do that, and it will be for sure next week, that is not helpful whatsoever. If I had to put a priority on this, I would say the seawater pipeline is probably the first priority, because that would immediately allow the foreign companies to fulfill their goals to increase capacity in the south, which can relatively easily export that oil. And my second priority would be to actually seriously reconsider building the north-to-south pipeline from the old days, which then would hook up to Ceyhan. So maybe I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Jean-François.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank MEI for inviting me here today. Thank my panelists, all of whom know more about Iraq and energy than I do. So what I'll talk to you about is U.S. policy and energy policy, both writ large and more specifically concerning Iraq. But before doing that and before looking forward, I think we all need to take a second and look backward and realize how much progress Iraq has made over the last year. Prime Minister Abadi, December 9th, declared victory over ISIS. As we all recall, over 4.5 million Iraqis have been freed from tyranny. Over 3.3 or 3.5 million Iraqi IDPs, have returned to their homes, and more are returning every day. There's a secure Iraq-Syria border. So before even prognosticating or pontificating on what might happen in Iraq in the future, I think tremendous credit needs to go to the government of Iraq for what's happened to get them to where we are today. Having said that, now let me talk about U.S. energy policy writ large and energy policy as it concerns Iraq. Under the Trump administration, there are three overarching goals for U.S. energy policy. The first is removing barriers to energy trade and development. The second is enhancing and supporting U.S. energy exports. That's both in terms of resources, services, and technologies. And the third strategic goal of the current administration's energy policy is to ensure the energy security both of the United States and also of our partners and allies, obviously, to include Iraq. This being an inside the Beltway event, I'm sure many of you have read the recent unclassified version of the Defense Department's national security strategy. And the high points there are even though the number one strategic priority for the United States in terms of national defense doctrine is no longer terrorism, it's the reemergence of interstate regional rivalries to include Russia and China. Having said that, preserving what we have attained in Iraq in terms of defeating ISIS and making sure both in Iraq and in the region that ISIS 2.0 or any other type of violent extremist group does not resurface to threaten the United States is of premier paramount importance in our national security strategy. Okay, so where are we in terms of Iraq? I think my panelists, my colleagues here, have in one form or another hit all the main points that I'm going to stress in terms of what the United States sees as crucially important in terms of Iraq's hydrocarbon sector. Again, because policymakers tend to talk in units of three, there are three priorities we have in terms of Iraq's hydrocarbon sector. The first and the most obvious of which is helping Iraq in its steps to reduce corruption. That is essential. Much like there are gas flare wastes in Iraq that preclude it from reaching its full economic potential, the issue of corruption is the functional equivalent of flaring. You're just losing so much efficiency, efficiency, and you're also making Iraq look less desirable to potential foreign investors. The second point is removing those barriers to trade, to investment in Iraq that are essential for Iraq to flourish. There was certainly, I think, not among those who follow Iraq closely, but perhaps for those who don't follow Iraq that closely, some confusion after the more recent conference in Kuwait about reconstruction. Some people mistakenly believed that the goal was to get, you know, $88 billion or so of donations. That's not the case. As we move in Iraq from stabilization to reconstruction, which is the longer-term strategic goal in Iraq, everyone realizes that one cannot reach that goal by donations alone from the international donor community. What has to happen is that Iraq has to become an attractive location for significant foreign and domestic investment so that it can attract the needed money. Longer term, the third priority in terms of what needs to happen in the Iraqi economy is diversifying the economy. Mm-hmm. Again, it's obvious right now that Iraq is getting the vast majority of its essential revenues from its oil production. In terms of how Iraq and to what extent Iraq adheres to OPEC production quotas, I think it's clear to everybody that just as OPEC has made exceptions to other countries in perilous or uncertain strategic situations, it makes sense for Iraq to be able to produce and sell as much oil as it can in the short term just to increase its revenues. Longer term, as my colleagues up here on the panel have said, Iraq needs to do more in terms of gas, mm-hmm. and in terms of petrochemicals. I mean, Iraq, like many of the countries in the region, have a long history of thinking of themselves as oil producers. So the number in its head about we produce this many million barrels a day or we export this many million barrels a day is an important, if not the most important, metric for many of those making energy policy. That shouldn't necessarily be the case. As many of us know, Iraq loses something like $2.5 billion a year right now due to gas flaring. And so it needs to do, and it realizes this, a much better job capturing flared gas. And it's starting down that road, as we all know. And in fact, that's one of the policies and one of the goals of our policy toward Iraq. Many of the largest IOCs have been in Iraq for a long time and know their way around Iraq. But in line with the three priorities of U.S. energy policy that I just spoke to you, one of the many endeavors that the U.S. government is trying to do is to help medium and small-sized U.S. companies who might not necessarily have significant international exposure make a profit and go to Iraq and both help the Iraqi hydrocarbon sector there and also help their own business. So there are U.S. companies, relatively medium-sized companies, in Iraq right now doing things like gas capture projects in the Basra area that are good both for Iraq and for U.S. business. So in sum, let's not neglect how fortunate Iraq is and how hard they've worked to get to where we are today. And everyone who is conversant with the hydrocarbon sector realizes what needs to be done. I just came from a Iraq Petroleum Conference in Berlin. In about 3 weeks, I'll be going to another one in Baghdad itself. I think Iraq has and those in the hydrocarbon sector have a very good idea of what needs to be done. So it's more a function of having the collective and distributive political will to do that which needs to be done, because that needs to happen for Iraq to be able to attract and to keep the significant international foreign investment that is an essential prerequisite, not just to rebuilding Iraq's hydrocarbon sector, but to rebuild, strengthen, and diversify its economy. Because If this doesn't happen, God forbid, as we all know, it's not just an economic failure, it's a security failure. And that doubles back to the preeminent goal of the Trump administration, which is to ensure the U.S. national security and the security of its citizens. And one of the ways we do that is to make sure that Iraq is a federal, democratic, united, and prosperous country. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. So let me start with you, Adam.
Okay.
And I have a three-part question. I mean, three questions, really, they are not.
That's honest. You said three-part questions.
No, three
questions.
There are three questions.
That's
you know?
Reporter's book, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they very much take off from what you just talked about.
Okay.
Which is the last thing you referred to is about this conference, you know, the annual conference in Berlin. And one of the criticisms that usually is leveled at the officials in Iraq is that they lack a long-term vision mm-hmm. of how they see the oil sector mm-hmm. evolving, where they mm-hmm. want it to go. And do you see that changing? You know, do you see that, I mean, the elements of that vision starting to develop? Mm-hmm. Do you see, you know, that's one. The second question has to do with the gas. And I thank you very much for raising this issue because it is an undervalued and underdeveloped, in my mm-hmm. opinion, resource for Iraq, which, and on one hand, it is less politicized than the oil, mm-hmm. and in that respect, it can provide a means of promoting collaboration between Erbil and Baghdad mm-hmm. Around the development of this sector. And on the other hand, also, it can be it could be the center or provide a platform for collaboration between Iraq and its neighbors mm-hmm. also mm-hmm. Over the gas resources. So in that respect, how do you see what Iraq needs to do mm-hmm. in terms, especially Baghdad, mm-hmm. to make this sector become I mean, what specific steps mm-hmm, mm-hmm. it needs to enact in order to, you know, harness the potential of the sector or make it mm-hmm. more, how to say, fulfill its role that it
sure,
can play in terms of creating economic growth. And then the third question, and again, please, I want the other panelists to feel free to address these three questions as well, building on what Alan has said.
Or contradicting.
Contradicting. Mm-hmm. Building, it can be agreeing or contradicting. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So, and the third question is this Erbil-Baghdad relationship, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of what the U.S. role is right now. How does the U.S. see its role in moving this relationship to a mm-hmm. more positive phase, you know?
Okay.
You can take any of these three questions.
I'll take them all very quickly, then okay. I'm sure my colleagues will have more substantive
yeah,
and
yeah.
more detailed answers than I have. Firstly, no, I don't think Iraqis, and I don't think Iraqi statesmen, politicians, technocrats like myself, lack a vision. As I said in the tail end of my comments, I think there are lots of visions, and I think everyone is clear as to what needs to be done. I think what is more important is a unified will to do that which everyone recognizes needs to be done. I mean, iteration of the problem is fun, and it's cathartic in a way, but it's not going to fix Iraq's economy. So I don't think we need a big, you know, consultant report, you know, Iraq Vision 20XX saying what needs to be done. They have those. There's, you know, documents, there's visions, there's short, medium, long-term plans that exist. I just think that a collective sense of urgency and drive to do the low-hanging fruit first and then step by step to implement the consensus vision that exists now among those conversant with the hydrocarbon sector is more important. And sure, there can be tweaks and changes to whatever vision, strategic vision that the hydrocarbon sector has, but those people, those Iraqis who are at the top of the hydrocarbon sector, they've been there a long time. No one really needs to teach them how to go about their business. I mean, I think they can obviously benefit from fresh outlooks and other points of view, but these people, they know the fields, they know the generic problems that Iraq faces that is currently prohibiting them from optimizing their hydrocarbon resources. So rather than vision, I think the political will is crucial. In terms of gas, yeah, gas is crucially important. In terms of what we need to do, the first step is awareness of the challenge or the problem, however you want to refer to it. That's already happening. As I mentioned, there are U.S. companies and other companies from other countries who are already starting to interact with Iraqis and the Iraqi government to offer proposals. There's a U.S. company, Orion, which has recently signed an MOU for gas capture in the Basra area. There are other companies pursuing projects. So I think what the U.S. government can do is continue to facilitate these meetings and this dialogue between the private sector and between Iraq, and also remind the government of Iraq what they need to do so that they can optimally develop their gas sector in terms of incorporating gas into the hydrocarbon law and other issues such as that. Erbil, Baghdad, yeah, I mean, that's obvious, and that's not a surprise. The United States is keenly desirous of Baghdad and Erbil having this discussion and reaching a rapprochement. As one of my co-panelists said here, you've got roughly 280,000 barrels in Kirkuk and Havana and Bay Hassan trapped in right now. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of barrels. So what needs to, and again, the airport's still being shut. The U.S. is doing all it can to facilitate dialogue between Baghdad and Erbil, and certainly an essential prerequisite to a long-term prosperous Iraqi economy is a modus vivendi between Baghdad and Erbil that, in all things being equal, includes, you know, the issue of hydrocarbons and sharing of resources. So those are my three answers, but I look forward to hearing what others say.
Would like to.
just maybe to comment on the gas issue. Of course, it's vital for the gas issue to get resolved. Shell oil is responsible for developing the natural gas in the south, but mostly by taking the associated gas from all the various fields and putting it together and then starting some electricity companies or power companies and so on. They've been at this for many years now, and they run into the same problem which ExxonMobil and CNPC have run into getting the seawater pipeline, is the competition, as far as I'm told, I mean, is the competition between the central government and the local authorities who everybody wants their pound of flesh, and nobody will give any permits or allow these companies to really develop their assets or the assets which they promised they would develop. So in the case of Shell, they've had a little bit of success this year, in all fairness, but they're really about 10 times behind what they really wanted to do in terms of production of natural gas. The other piece of the natural gas, of course, is the fact that the KRG has a fair amount of natural gas, and there's this plan to send the natural gas to Turkey. And the Turks are quite eager to put a pipeline on for the KRG down all the way to link with the Turkish pipelines. So I'm not sure what's going to happen there. It's not terribly being encouraged by Baghdad at this point, as far as I can tell. But it's an interesting possibility. I'll just finish with the one point which Alan made, which I thought was absolutely fantastic, and is that the Iraqi engineers were among the very, very best. And, the oil company of Iraq, I can't say in the good old days, but in the old days, were really well reputed all over the world and did very well. Unfortunately, it was a long time ago. Many have died. Many have left Iraq or retired. So there's a big challenge there for Iraq to come back to that. But there's absolutely no reason why they can't do that.
A quick question, building on the point that Alan mentioned about one of the priorities of the U.S. administration is to create opportunities for medium and small-sized U.S. energy companies to also be involved in the oil sector in Iraq. And I wonder how the contracting requirements that Baghdad today, has, which is more, which doesn't create a favorable incentive structure, I mean, for small and medium companies, compared, for example, to the to the contracts that the KRI, for example, offered. And so how do you see that as an obstacle going forward? I know there have been discussions about, you know, between the oil minister and, you know, oil companies about seeing some of these contracts change, which are very much an inheritance of the pre-2005 you know, contractual arrangement that Iraq had.
I think it would be great to see American middle, you know, middle of the road companies be able to get involved. But to get involved in anywhere in the Middle East, but especially in Iraq, requires an enormous amount of capital.
Exactly.
And frankly, I don't think the middle-sized companies in these countries would have the capital or the stomach to be able to do this for years and years and years. It's really for the big companies. They can do it because they have the capacity to think 10 years ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And by capacity, I mean the financial wherewithal to do it. Mm-hmm. So I would love to see those middle-sized companies do that, but I'm a little skeptical that it would happen.
Okay. Just one quick point, actually. In general, that could be true, but some of these medium-sized, mid-sized U.S. companies are self-financing, which is they've got the technology. The technology captures gas that otherwise would have been flared and monetizes it and, you know, changes it around. I'm not a chemical engineer, so I can't go into details. But so although that could be in general true, the hydrocarbon sector takes a lot of money to play in. Again, in terms of some of the gas options in Iraq, high initial investment or high initial financial commitment by the Iraqi government is not necessarily an essential prerequisite.
But I think what could happen in something like this is that the smaller companies would come on the coattails of the large companies.
That could also be the case.
I mean,
what about the contracts, this issue of...
of course, that's well true. And that, I think we all touched on that, which is that you know, of course, you're talking to someone who's been in government his whole life, so I don't want to pontificate on what you know, U.S. businessmen are looking for or international businessmen. But it is the case that business people are looking for, first of all, contracts that are beneficial to them and contracts you can count on. So,
exactly.
You know, those are the necessary sufficient conditions. They have to be good terms, and you have to be able to assume that those terms will continue. And again, and this is, to me, the most vital point about what's happening in Iraq right now, business can invest all over the place. And especially considering the price of hydrocarbons and oils these days, so many international companies are just sticking to the U.S. They're investing in the Permian. They're investing in the Bakken. So for Iraq to attract the necessary international investment, it's going to have to make itself look attractive. And that means not just contracts that are beneficial to the investors, but also the sanctity of contract, you know, the ability to seek recourse, you know, a legal system that encourages international investment.
Omar.
Yeah.
I mean, feel free to pick up on what has been said earlier, but also I want you to address an issue which you have not touched in your remark when you talk about the domestic fault lines that have impacted the oil, you know, sector or the domestic politics of the oil sector, and you talk mostly along of these politics along the Baghdad-Erbil axis.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know, also the intra-Shia divisions
right.
are as important going forward. And we have now the PMU, you know, playing being an important component, you know, going forward, or a player. How important
Certainly.
It's going to be, we'll see, you know, with the elections. And through that actor, Iran will be trying to seek to expand its influence over, you know, the future of the country, but also over its oil policies going forward as far as the regional landscape. So if you can talk about how you see the intra-Shia division post-elections affecting this debate.
All right. Yeah, it's a tricky territory. You know, I think we definitely have seen Iran make itself more visible in Iraq's energy sector over the last several years. We've seen gas imports coming in from Iran to power electricity power stations in Baghdad, and I think there is also a plan to send that to Basra as well. this whole oil swap that's been happening, or that's been discussed with regard to Kirkuk. Iran for several years has been pushing or let's say trying to pull Kirkuk's oil towards its border and away from, you know, regional rival Turkey. That was polarizing, actually, internal, not only Shia politics, but internal Kurdish politics, as, you know, different political factions were thinking about, you know, weighing the options of should we send our oil all through Turkey or through through Iran. So, you know, the recent incarnation of that is that deal about trucking some of the Kirkuk oil to the Kermanshah, I think, refinery in exchange for an oil swap in the south. So I think we'll see more of that probably if, depending on how the elections are going to shape up. I think there is, if I want to speculate about the outcome of elections, probably going to be very, power is going to be very diffuse. We're not going to see one party gain a plurality of votes, I think, of seats right away. I think the largest bloc will emerge the day after at the negotiations table, rather than on the through the election through the ballots themselves. And I think, you know, like you said, the there are certain factions within the Shia establishment that will probably favor more interaction, more cooperation with Iran, with the neighbor to the east, than with, you know, international oil companies or with Western interests. And I think with Iran also comes Russia.
Exactly.
Also. And yeah. That has, we've seen, yeah. You know, Russia come in parallel with Iran, both in especially in Kurdistan
KRI.
And,
yeah.
in Iraq South as well.
Yeah.
There has been a growing Russian presence that's probably going to, you know, expand in the future. We know that Rosneft's entry into the KRG oil export pipeline is going to be one of the it's going to make Russia unremovable from that sector.
Exactly.
So I could go on and on about the politics, but just a couple of words I think about the other issues. I think one of the points that would be desirable, I think, for Iraq in the future and to advance its energy sector and make it more attractive is to gradually prioritize commercial interests and dial down the ideology and rhetoric, because I think that has been, you know, that's been hot. That has been driving policy for years. But, you know, as the country, you know, wakes up from this whole 2003 transition, it needs to catch up to its energy sector growth and realize that to unlock the potential, it cannot continue to place so much emphasis on ideology. And going back to the CSSP issue, which is Common Seawater Supply Project.
Thank you.
The original problem was that Baghdad did not allow Exxon to carry on the project was because in 2011 or 2012, Exxon decided to sign up for six exploration blocks with the KRG, and that caused the derailment of the water project. If that issue was normalized and integrated or simply isolated from the rest of the energy sector, the oil fields in Basra and Nasri and Maysan would have all the water that they need to ramp up the production to the levels that Iraq wanted to see.
Thank you. Erin,
yeah.
Again, feel free to pick up on what has been said and add, disagree, but I want you also to address the Kurdish issue, the Kurdish dimension here. Well, we have recently seen at least two developments. We have seen the intra-Kurdish division at the level of the political elites, and some would argue that will create space for civil society, you know, for civil, civil, for you know, public advocacy groups to come in and push for more transparency, for more accountability in terms of resource management, in terms of how the funds from these sectors are being used and distributed. And the second is these protests that we have seen also, civil protest against the leadership due to, lack of payment of salaries, bad economic conditions. Again, we are seeing maybe the activation of some kind of mobilization of with a common agenda focused on common interest, economic interest. So how do you see that impacting the sector within the KRI, but also how you see that impacting Baghdad-Erbil relations over resource management, revenue sharing going forward?
Sure. Okay. So I think corruption and transparency issues have been sliced and diced, over the years in several different ways. And I think, civil society groups have called for more transparency within the KRG. And that demand has been one that hasn't, I don't want to say not been taken seriously, but hasn't been fully brought into the fold in a way that some of these civil society groups that you're talking about wish it had. We, as I had said earlier, we do have international auditing firms working within the KRG right now to go through oil revenues back into a few years, I think to 2014. I actually think that it needs to go back to 2004, 2005, 2006. I think that that's a step forward, but I don't think it's necessarily enough, and I don't think that the people that I've talk to thinks enough. I think that transparency is one of the major issues that they talked about with me, that, they don't know what goes on behind closed doors, that they don't really understand, what's happening behind the scenes, and that's a major issue for them, and it really affects their livelihoods day to day. It affects how they're going to make money. It affects their ability to find jobs, their ability to keep jobs, as I said. And it affects, for those who do hold jobs, it affects their payments. I was in the KRG at a time when civil servants were not being paid or hadn't been paid, one person I talked to, for 6 months. I was at one of the main hospitals there talking to the director of the hospital, who said, I can't blame my doctors if they don't come in every day because they're out driving taxi cabs trying to make money. And that was really surprising for me. And I think these issues are, throughout all the different sectors in the KRG, not just, the doctor or hospital business. But that was really, shocking to hear. In terms of civil unrest, in terms of the demands that people are making, I feel as though there is a movement now among civil society, demanding answers, wanting answers as to why their economy is the way it is now. They want a better understanding of how things will change and move forward. But there is still that part of the population that sort of sits back and tries not to engage all that much because they've been dealing with this for years and feel as though nothing will change. So I think that there's stark difference in that population between the people who are, perhaps in university or engaged in politics in the KRG and are active in that sector, and then the people who, I talked to a woman who, she has 6 kids. She lives outside Erbil, and her husband basically sits on the road most days trying to get picked up for odd jobs in construction, and that's the way he provides for his family. And she doesn't think that, the conversations going on in the political sector right now in the KRG are really going to help her immediate day-to-day life. Yeah. And I think that's important to think about. And one thing, going back to the contract issue and the importance of keeping contracts and the importance of, having contracts that you can count on, I think we've seen this issue arise in the KRG, especially when it comes to oil. I have talked to, oil executives about this at length, and one of them said, "I'm extremely wary of all the half measures and broken promises made by various groups and their interdepartment bickering. All it does is cost us fruitless money and delays the development of the region." I think that's pretty indicative of not all, but what some you know, executives think.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. We have 26 minutes that we can engage in a conversation, you know, with the panel. I think we have micros, right, that are going to go around. Please, for those of you who would like to ask a question, again, this is a question and answer. You ask the question, they answer.
Or not answer.
Yeah, of course. And what I'm going to try to do is to group the questions. I mean, so to have maybe three questions at a time, and feel free to say, you know, whether the question is addressed to all the panelists, or to one of the panelists, or to two or three, whatever of the panelists. So, who would like to go first? Please, sir.
Hello, Horatio Ureta, former Department of State, with a couple of tours in the Middle East. For everybody, we're all here in this room and kind of agree, yes, Iraq improving its hydrocarbon capabilities, capacity is all well and good. What about those in the region that are probably not as enthusiastic of Iraq taking away their market share of hydrocarbons, i.e. the Arab Gulf Sunni oil monarchies and all that? I mean, they're probably not looking at, yeah, great, Iraq is pumping more oil, great, so it's taking away our market share. So, again, any comments on that?
So please write down the questions, and then, okay, sir, yes, second question, please, there.
My name is Andy Snow. I'm the State Department fellow. Sorry, a little heavy on the State Department today. At the United States Institute of Peace, and I spent several years working on Iraq, both in Iraq and here. But my question is for Mr. Al-Nadawi, if that's okay. And that is, we talked about, several of the panel members talked about the importance of some of these sort of low-hanging fruit things, especially gas capture. But what my experience working on Iraq issues is, even things that everybody agrees need to be done can be extraordinarily difficult to do. And gas is, I think, perhaps the perfect example of that. Can you drill down a little bit on why that's been so difficult? I mean, for years, everybody's agreed it's extremely important to capture the gas. Mm-hmm. And you'd think that wouldn't be that hard. And yet, it's moved really slowly. So any thoughts on that? Thanks.
Okay. Third question there in the back here.
Jason Pack, Executive Director of the U.S. Libya Business Association. Thanks for a very interesting panel. I want to toss out a few parallels with Libya and hear what you have to say. When I heard the discussion between Mr. Airi and Jean-Francois, two dynamics I thought were worth exploring further. The one is, now is a situation in which the oil majors feel that if they have expertise and money, they can make a quick profit. Think of, for example, Marathon selling out of its fields in Libya just late last week, and many others who are seeing the plays in the Permian and the Bakken. Libya and Iraq have among the best oil in the world in terms of how cheap it is to get out of the ground, but that doesn't make it easy to turn a profit because of the tax regimens and the way in which the production sharing agreements are done.
Correct.
Could you comment on what could be done legally, both by the Erbil government and the Baghdad government, to make it a more attractive place, not from the, oh, is it going to be politically secure or is there going to be respect of contract, but just from the pure taxation / EPSA perspective? And I know that this is something that you've thought about in the Libyan case as well. And then the second part is, when I heard about the Blocton field in Kirkuk, of course I thought about the Federalists with Jadran and the situation at Sidra and Ras Lanuf in 2014 and 2015, whereby everyone loses with the Blocton field, but it's nearly impossible to get it to change. So what could be done to create a win-win when you have a kind of game theory position of chicken that no one wants to break the stalemate? And is there a Libya parallel of how to get out of that issue of the Blocton field? Thank you so much.
Thank you. I suggest that, Jean-Francois, you take that first question about where the Saudis specifically on this market share issue.
I think the market share issue is actually a non-issue in a sense, because I don't think the Gulf countries are very worried about market share, losing market share to Iraq. The Saudis in particular, they produce now 10 million barrels a day, and their plan is to actually get out of crude sales. They want to produce crude, but they want to go downstream from that, and they are spending an enormous amount of money going into refining and chemicals, so they will sell products and chemicals and very value-added production. So they're quite happy to leave the sort of low-profit, dirty job of selling crude to the Iraqis and the Iranians. So I'm not sure that's really an enormous problem. One quick thing on the taxation issue and so on. I think the problem, fundamentally, my personal opinion on the problems between the KRG and Iraq, is really a question of trust. Mm. I mean, the KRG went on its own many years ago. Why? Because they were always afraid that the Iraqis would not pay. And, you know, the Iraqis were supposed to pay 17%, and when the payment came due, they never paid. So I think the KRG just wanted to do it on its own. They don't trust each other. So how do you resolve that? I don't know. But Omar knows.
Would you like to address also this question?
No,
I was going to actually talk more about the second one, about the low-hanging fruit,
yes.
So to speak.
Yeah.
I think there were two parts of, you know, to the gas question. I think there are, you have your non-associated gas development, or you have your associated gas development. With the non-associated gas development, I think there was, Iraq started working on that, I think starting with the third licensing round in 2009 or 2010. There were deals with Kogas in the Akkas field in Anbar. There were deals there was a license in Diyala, but security got in the way. You know, ISIS happened, and that really derailed those projects that were probably going to meet, first commercial gas by now. I think Siba, the field in Basra, the gas field in Basra that was awarded to Kuwait Energy, is just about to send out its first gas. So see the difference between, an operation that happens in Basra versus an operation that happens in out in the middle of nowhere in Anbar province or Diyala. With associated gas, yes, you know, it seems like a low-hanging fruit in terms of how, you know, you just cap the flare and collect the gas. But unless you have, you know, a way of disposing of the gas, unless you have a way of putting it to use, it becomes really a economically, commercially difficult, calculation. You need either nearby power generation, you need a power plant that to take up that gas, and often, you know, power plants are not just conveniently show up next to oil fields where the gas is there. There is no export infrastructure for that, because you'll need either to build an expensive long pipeline to your neighbors, and I think one was, you know, we know the complications of building one to Turkey, and there were also plans to build one to Jordan, but that was also disrupted by security concerns and ISIS. So if you can't export by pipeline, you need to export by as a liquefied natural gas, and that's very expensive and technologically difficult. I think part of the Basra Gas Company project involves building an LNG platform, but that takes several billion dollars. So it's not really low-hanging fruit that way. The other option, of course, to using gas is petrochemicals, but that's also been that's also a long-term investment that requires a lot of capital investment and technical expertise that are not, you know, readily available. So, you know, the wellhead can be simple, but what to do afterward, I think, can be quite challenging.
Aaron, can you add to the point which was raised by Jean-François on the lack of trust between Erbil and Baghdad as being a major issue going forward? And the question is, how is this seen from the people's side? You know, is it a lack of trust? Is it about lack of trust in Baghdad, or is it about lack of trust in their own leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lack of trust, you know, between political parties in the KRG, between, you know, Erbil and Baghdad. I mean, I think the lack of trust is sort of a theme seen throughout the entire country between whether it's, you know, political rivals or, you know, the central government and the KRG. And I think that's one of the major issues. And in terms of how the local people feel about that is that they're very strong alliances. There are very strong alliances, right? You're aligned with, you know, your political party or the people in your neighborhood or what have you. And that the sort of lack of trust that exists really permeates throughout the entire, you know, economic sector, even in the KRG, and I see that as sort of one of the major issues going forward in terms of how it will impact the local economy. Even, you know, think outside politics and think outside, you know, political rivalries. I mean, that exists, you know, within the local economy as well. And I think I don't have an answer for how do we fix that. I don't really know how you fix trust in Iraq, right? I mean, I think that's an age-old question. I don't think any of us have that answer. But I think it's something that definitely needs to be addressed moving forward. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, the last question, I think, that was...
Yeah, I mean, there are interesting parallels and differences, obviously, Jason, between Iraq and Libya, both in terms of where each are on the security line. I mean, Iraq, as I said in the introduction of my comments, knock wood, you know, seems to have solved, at least for now, the immediate security threats it faces. Libya, not so. And if I recall your question directly, what is it that these countries need to do in order to attract the essential foreign investment? There is where I think it's different. Mm-hmm. I think in Libya, I mean, first and foremost, you have to establish a stability on the ground that is currently existing in Iraq, but is not yet existing in Libya. You obviously know the situation in Libya with granularity. I don't. But it seems to me to be the case that just the strategic realities of Libya right now haven't achieved the homeostasis that exists in Iraq. I mean, like I said, I was in Berlin last week for the Iraq Petroleum Conference, and a number of Iraqi statesmen made the point of, despite all the Sturm und Drang and troubles Iraq has had over the last how many years, they've always had regular elections. And that's huge. I mean, again, there's a lot of things we shouldn't overlook. That's one of them. Iraq has held elections routinely, on time more or less. And obviously that's not the case in Libya. We're still grappling toward a political solution in Libya. So I think that you have the conditions in Iraq with, and maybe this is the wrong word, I won't say tweaking, but refining and recalibrating investment conditions so that international money, despite the ambient risk, decides that there's a high enough potential reward to go back in Iraq. I think that's the goal in Iraq. In Libya, I don't think we're there yet.
Yes.
So that, to me, is the most important difference between the two. And hopefully, again, I mean, I think the head of the Libyan oil company, engineer Sanullah, has done an amazing job in terms of getting Libyan production up. He and his team at the oil company have done miracles to get the government of Libya the funding it needs in order to at least have the chance for longer-term stability. So hats off to him and to his team for doing what they've done in the face of almost insurmountable obstacles in ways I don't have time to talk about. And hopefully that will continue and Libya will stabilize, and then we'll start having the same conversations about Libya that we're having now about Iraq.
I promise to end sharp at 3:30, which I would like to keep as promised. So I'll take two questions. A quick question. Please, sir.
I think my question, my name's Nick Riker. My question really, I think, is why should foreign investors from where we are now invest in Iraq's oil industry or Iraq's economy more generally? I invested in Iraq's oil industry in 2010, and for 2 years that looked like a really wise thing to have done, whereas now it looks incredibly foolish and naive. So what do we need to do to get those kind of investments to go back from foolish to wise.
Is this to everybody or? Yeah? Okay. Let me take second question. You know? Yes, please go ahead.
How can mid-range U.S. companies be encouraged to play a role in Iraq, given that the PMU is still visible there? And there was a pamphlet that spoke about Turkish involvement. What are the prospects of Turkey and Iraq making some type of exchange and bettering relations in regards to water and introducing that as a part of a long-term sustainable effort?
Okay. Who would like to take
I'll take the first question.
Okay.
I think that I'll go back to the point I made earlier about the large energy companies. If you think of investing with a basis of 2, 3, 4 years to get your money back and make a little profit, it's just, I agree with you, it's foolish. But most of the large oil companies have a basic horizon of 10 years, sometimes more. And if you do that, then you have to invest now to reap the benefits in 10 years' time. And I think that's why companies like Shell and BP and Exxon and all these people and Total and the Chinese companies, which are very, very important in Iraq today, are investing fairly heavily now, even though they have all the problems we have mentioned endlessly, and they will continue to have endless problems. But in 10 years' time, it's eternity. And that they can afford to wait for that, and because if it works, it will work really well.
All right. There was other questions raised about Turkey and about, right, Turkey and,
I wonder if you can rephrase the question or repeat it.
Well, basically, there was talk of water playing a role, and seawater playing a role into that. As far as infrastructure, not infrastructure, energy development, you talk about diversifying the Iraqi economy, and all we talked about was energy, but what about the infrastructure, what about hydroelectric dams, the water resources that come from Turkey that have not been coming as much over the past 10 years, and how that could play a role in sustainable development in between both countries and bettering relations. There is the issue with the Mosul Dam. There's other ways we can develop the Iraqi economy besides the Iraqi sector. And not only that, the commodities alone in regards to energy and oil have been fluctuating at a degree where it may not be as the incentive may not be there for the U.S. mid-range U.S. company to go into Iraq and face the issue of taxes long-term. So, and how can they even be guaranteed the security given that Iranian terrorists are still all over the country? So, I don't know how they would feel secure in doing that. They seem to have a good relationship with the KRG, but now those connections have now fled. So, if the Iraqis themselves can't even get along with the Kurds, how can U.S. companies feel that same feeling that they're going to have a long-term benefit in investing in Iraq?
And a quick question I would like to add to the issue of Turkey is the KRG debt, you know, especially debt to Turkish companies, which supposedly amounts to about $4 billion.
Yeah.
And in the last conversation, negotiations between Baghdad and Ankara, Baghdad said it's not willing to honor
right.
those debts. And so what is the pathway forward on this going
forward? Right. Let me start first, I think, with the PMU question. You know, that's an issue I think that Iraqis are aware of, that the existence of weapons outside the formal government security institutions. There has been a law that was passed last year to try and contain and regulate the presence of the armed factions that, you know, volunteer to aid and augment Iraq's security forces in the aftermath of the 2014 catastrophe in Mosul. So far, honestly, I have not seen reports of significant issues affecting the work of major international oil companies in Iraq. There is, however, and I think, you know, this is becoming a priority for the Iraqi government, there is a big security problem with organized crime problems in Basra and other southern provinces. And that has been a result of the redeployment of most of the security forces from those regions to Iraq's west and northern provinces in the fight against ISIS. So the government is now shifting to its attention back to the south. There are serious operations that have been taking place against organized crime, smuggling, including oil smuggling operations. So I think that's on the radar. On the debt, if you look at the budget law that just passed, it involves an article, a provision that says there shall be no, I'm paraphrasing, no borrowing against future oil sales without the agreement of without the approval of Parliament. So that's going to be an issue. It's going to be the most sticky issue, I think, in normalizing relations between the oil and budget issues between Baghdad and Erbil. I think the best or way out of this is to probably try to parse these issues and separate them from one another. You don't need to agree on how to pay the debt. You don't need to agree on the debt mechanism in order to agree on an oil revenue or like an oil investment or an oil operation law. That can be structured later. And I think probably U.S. government input could be extremely important in mediating that discussion.
Perfect segue. Please.
Well, just one quick, you raised a very good point about renewables, and you're right, it wasn't addressed, I think, to my mind sufficiently, just probably due to the constraints of time today. But the Iraqi government is aware of the possibilities and opportunities associated with renewable energy. I know they're increasingly active on solar power. I know of at least one American company doing a solar power project in Iraq now, or hoping to do one. And the point there is that obviously if you can provide domestic energy through renewable energy, through solar power, then you have more hydrocarbons to export, which is certainly, at least in the minds of many of the people with whom I spoke last week in Berlin, desirable to have that opportunity.
And the issue of the debts, or we have no position on this?
Refresh my memory.
It's the debts that is owed, KRG debt owes to Turkish companies.
Without having the granularity, but the issue of debt The international business community, the international investment community, looks at how sovereign entities and how the KRG deals with debt issues. And it's not just enough, as I said before, to have a good contract, but if you're stiffing people on what you owe them, you know, the international investment community notices that. So, yeah, I think that to the extent that Iraq and also the KRG shows that it is able to deal with its debt in a timely and fair manner, it will attract more investment, and the converse of that is also true.
All right. One last question, quick.
It's not a question. If you allow me to make a few comments on the debt to Turkey and other actually international oil companies.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is Ghazi Shbekat from the IMF.
Okay.
The sharing agreement actually involves not only the transfer from the federal government to KRG, but also how much the KRG should transfer in oil revenue to the federal government. And what is also problematic in this budget is that the 250,000 worth of barrels a day is supposed to be transferred without taking consideration of these obligations that the KRG has against Turkey and against other international companies. And since the government has not committed to repay those, someone has to repay these obligations, and this transfer should be taken into account when they look at how much the KRG can transfer to Baghdad. Right now, they assumed how much oil is going to be produced, which is about 250, and that should be to go to the budget in exchange for the 6.7 trillion from the government spending.
Well, that's correct. It is a gap in the formula, and actually it doesn't limit it to 250,000 barrels per day. It says if should there be excess surplus production, that also should be accounted for by both sides. That if Basra produces more oil, or if Erbil produces more oil, then that also goes all goes to the federal treasury. It's a big problem. How that debt is going to be financed. Now, My reading was quick of the budget bill this morning. There is a provision for paying the cost of oil production from the sovereign expenditures of the government. Mm. And the language didn't specify that, or did not limit it to what the Iraqi government owes to IOCs in this province or that. So that could be
loophole.
Potentially
loophole. Yeah.
Could be
yeah.
grandfathered in, but you know that's yeah. again very quick. My reading from a very quick skim of the document.
Thank you very much for joining us, and please join me in thanking our terrific panel. Thank you.